Welcome to the Middle Market Growth Conversations podcast. I'm Katie Maloney. The private credit market is booming right now, and it's attracting many new entrants as well as regulatory scrutiny. Here today to discuss the private credit world and how Whitehorse Capital is navigating the competitive landscape are my guests, Javier Casillas, Chief Credit Officer, and Sam Goldworm, Managing Director, both with Whitehorse. Sam and Javier, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you, Katie.
So Sam, let's start with you. Can you set the stage by telling us about Whitehorse Capital and the strategies the firm uses to stay competitive in today's private credit market, even as so many new entrants are coming into the space?
Sure, I'd be happy to. So Whitehorse Capital is the private credit arm of HIG Capital. HIG is a $60 billion plus alternative asset manager, founded by a former Blackstone private equity partner and a bank consulting partner over 30 years ago. At Whitehorse, we operate out of a pool of capital of about $12 billion, which means we make loans in the range of, call it $30 million on the low end, up to close to $300 million on the high end. We're split probably 30-70 non-sponsor to sponsor. And when we say non-sponsor, we've been great financial partners for entrepreneurs, family-owned businesses, family office-owned businesses, small public companies. And we also have had a lot of success with independent sponsors. And we put that category in the non-sponsor bucket as well. We do have a robust sponsor business, about 70% of the capital we deploy on an annual basis. Industry-wise, we tend to do everything, except we don't do project finance or real estate-based finance because we have groups within HIG that do that. In terms of how we stay competitive in what is a white-hot market is, I think, threefold. One is we have a very wide and deep origination effort. We have over 20 originators spread all over the country in places like Ohio and DC, as well as kind of more marquee cities like Chicago, Atlanta, and New York. And when we put those individuals in those cities, they tend to be from those cities and tend to have embedded networks that help for a competitive process. So for example, my partner Jay in Atlanta is from Atlanta. My partner Matt in LA is from LA. My partner Peter is from Chicago, and that certainly helps. Secondarily, I'm often asked by LPs, with so many entrants into the private credit space, hasn't it gotten so competitive? True, but we also emphasize that with every private credit entrance, there's also a new private equity entrant and a new investment banking or intermediary effort. And so we've been very good about getting to those new institutions and being a trusted partner with them early and often. And the last part is, I think that we have been known as a reliable surety of closing type organization. And so that reputation has bled into the market. And so we tend to be a first phone call for sometimes a situation where timing is of the essence, or if it's a complicated situation where we can be helpful to a sponsor or non-sponsor borrower who needs someone to unpack a situation fast.
Now, thanks for that background, Sam. And I want to come back to your point about Whitehorse's affiliation as part of a larger alternatives platform. So Javier, can you describe the advantages and disadvantages of that relationship and that structure?
Of course. And touching on one point from the question before, I do think a competitive advantage is having been in the market for a long time. So I like to say that here at Whitehorse, we've been doing direct lending since before it was cool, back since 2010. And really, it was a direct outgrowth of the work that HIG was already doing in the middle market and the lower middle market. I think being part of a larger platform does have some very significant advantages. Sam touched on this, physical scale, being in a lot of cities. That would only be possible if there were efficiencies that went along with sharing some of those offices with other strategies, having the existing relationships to be able to hire talented people in those markets, et cetera. And that makes a big difference in being able to originate deals that aren't necessarily heavily competitive and marketed. The second is very deep catalog of industry and vertical expertise. This firm has owned hundreds of companies, has industry groups that have very specific points of view on which industries are interesting and not interesting, which subsectors you can lean in on and which ones you shouldn't. And we collaborate with all of those people. The incentives to collaborate across the platform, both geographically and asset-wise are hardwired into how we're all compensated. And so when you think about, and we speak about this with our limited partners all the time, when you think about competing with standalone direct lending shops, those are some advantages that would be really impossible to garner if you just started, you know, the strategy on a greenfield basis, and you know, advantages that we're really blessed to have.
And Sam, turning back to you, both you and Javier touched on this a little bit, but I was hoping you could talk a little bit more about how WhiteHorse structures its team.
Yeah, so we believe in a bifurcated model in that we have originators and we have an execution team. And so the originators are out spread around the country, bringing in as much deal flow as possible and trying to filter it at the front end. And if at that juncture, the originator feels like it's a quality opportunity, we staff a credit team to do a fair amount of diligence and bring it to a committee. We have a very concise investment committee that is quite honestly a single black ball effort. So we need to have everyone agree that this is a good opportunity to pursue. We think that eliminates groupthink. We think it precludes originators from bullying a deal team into doing a bad transaction. So we have a very strong execution team that helps an originator evaluate opportunity, put it in presentation form to discuss at an investment committee. And Javier is the chief credit officer, obviously runs that execution team. It's quite deep. We have 71 investment professionals working at the firm within WhiteHorse. And a deal team would normally consist of 3 to 5 individuals, depending on the complexity. So it would be an originator, partner, a execution partner, as well as, you know, usually 2 to 3 support execution resources. And so we find that eliminates transactions that go wrong and allows us to go eyes wide open into a transaction of potential risk down the road, how we would handle it, and also to get speed and certainty to our borrowing clients. I think because we meet so frequently as a committee, generally sometimes 2 to 3 times a week, we can get LOIs out to intermediaries and their clients rapidly and move on efforts that need capital expeditiously.
And in your view, Sam, is it preferable to have a centralized origination footprint or a more distributed one when dealing with the borrower universe?
Yeah, I probably sound like a dinosaur here, but I think we firmly believe as a firm that you need to be out there meeting, shaking hands with management teams, meeting, shaking hands with the intermediaries, and not only discussing the WhiteHorse message, but understanding these people's companies. And there's just only so much that can be done via Zoom. And so we believe in having a very wide and deep origination effort. I always joke with some of our LPs that it's not uncommon to see another, you know, WhiteHorse colleague at, you know, an airport lounge at JFK or Dulles or O'Hare, because we are constantly going out there meeting these people. And we feel like it's important to have a spread out effort to have the opportunity to meet intermediaries and management teams. And so we firmly believe that there are opportunities that are regional and that we need to have a regional presence to feel these opportunities and analyze these opportunities and execute these opportunities in a rapid fashion.
And when it comes to diligence, Javier, what are some of the advantages and disadvantages of organizing the team around industry verticals?
So I think when deciding on team structure vertical-wise, you have to take a couple things into consideration. One is there enough volume in a particular vertical to make it worth specializing? And then the second is, does that particular space really require specialized or technical knowledge in order to be successful? And so we've determined a few sectors where that is the case, namely healthcare, technology, logistics, e-commerce. And those are all spaces where a deal comes in. There are subsectors within each of those verticals. The sector lead can decide whether that's a good fit for what we're trying to do, whether it's a space you should try to stay away from, can generate comps based on the hundreds of deals that we've already seen, and then come back fairly credibly and fairly quickly to our counterparty with an indication. So one of the big advantages is speed and a crisp response, which I think counterparties really appreciate. The second significant advantage is that you can avoid losses. I think a lot of direct lenders take their worst losses when they are acting as tourists in a new space that has some real complexity. So one example that comes to mind is anything that has to do with government reimbursed healthcare. There are a lot of deals that seem really attractive on paper, but have some fairly binary and hairy risks around regulation and reimbursement that you may not catch if it's the first deal that you do in that space. And then finally, one of the, I wouldn't say disadvantages, but considerations is that from a career development standpoint, you do want credit investors to have a broad exposure to the team and different sectors and different situations. And so we tend to ask people to specialize later in their careers once they've already done a lot of credit investing and been around for several years with the firm. And so that tends to be a pretty tried and true way of creating what we call sort of a soft vertical organization, where you think about it both in terms of, is it appropriate for a particular vertical, but also is it appropriate for the particular person that is growing through or having a trajectory through your organization.
And can you also talk about the ideal structure for handling workout situations, Javier? Is it better to have in-house specialists, or do you typically rely on deal teams and outside parties?
Mm-hmm. Yep, good question. I think you need both. And I would add one variable to that. I do think it's important to keep the initial credit teams on deals when they get troubled, because that's where the original underwriting expertise lies. And frankly, it creates some accountability for doing bad deals. So, you know, you have to kind of eat what you cook, if you will. And the reason to have specialized expertise in-house, which we do, our partner David Indelicato leads that effort, is because you need to have consistency and speed around how you deal with similar situations. So the best example is probably COVID, where you have a lot of borrowers asking for very similar things, and you need to be providing consistent messaging to the market around what your philosophy is around different asks. And that was extremely helpful in that point period of time, and something that we've continued to do since then. And you know, a lot of these asks are very normal and recur. And so that's one area where having the specialist helps, because you're emitting the same message. But then also, there are situations as workouts sometimes further develop where you need outside parties to either help you with a certain more mode of analysis or data collection, or very technical legal matters with respect to, for instance, seeking remedies, where you absolutely need smart outside parties that you've worked with consistently. One example would be having a stable of independent directors that you can place on boards when necessary. So having folks that you've worked with in the past and are constructive and responsible with respect to those situations is important, and actually harder than you would think in terms of being able to identify quality folks for those roles. And so it's really a little bit of both, but I would emphasize that ultimately you need a conductor, if you will, that sits on top of the several, you know, handful of situations, workout situations that you have at any given time, to make sure that we're acting consistently with the philosophy that we have around those situations, and also managing our outside parties in an effective manner.
And then building on that, Javier, in these situations, how do you balance the needs of both your borrowers and your investors?
So if I understand the question correctly, I think it's probably around how appropriate is it to be, you know, really proactive in workouts. And sometimes, you know, unfortunately, that is in a way where you're across the table from the folks that you're originally partnered with. And that is, you know, a fact of life that happens from time to time. I would say that in 90% of cases, you are actually quite aligned with the owners of the business in trying to develop a recovery, because obviously the owners of the business will experience a total loss unless you experience a good recovery as the senior lender. And whether that means a change in strategy at the company, restructuring of overhead, those are all things that our partners tend to be, you know, quite good at doing. That being said, there are times when those interests become misaligned, perhaps because the only way to achieve an equity recovery is through a fairly aggressive and risky strategy let's say with respect to capital expenditures, but in a way that creates a probabilistically worse outcome for the lenders. And then, you know, your first duty there is to have a constructive and transparent conversation with your owners. And to the extent that you recognize that, you know, misalignment is not reconcilable, that's where I think you really have to start thinking about a recovery and protecting the best interests of your investors. And, you know, that can take many forms. You know, unfortunately, all direct lenders end up owning companies, you know, from time to time. And when that happens, you need to be prepared to really operate those companies. You know, fortunately, our workout team has a seasoned professional who formerly did private equity here at HIG and is perfectly capable of making, you know, difficult decisions within those companies to maximize the recovery for our investors. But it is important for you to be able to be willing to do that and to ultimately to be able to do that in order to have the negotiating capacity to realize the best outcomes and recoveries for your LPs.
And then finally, to close us out, I would be remiss not to ask about regulation, which is a really hot topic right now. With the proliferation of private credit in recent years, there's been greater scrutiny and calls for increased regulation in some corners. So as a practitioner working within private credit, Javier, how would you respond to the concerns about risk and some of these calls for more guardrails?
Yep, timely question. So I think there's a balance. Just to provide some context, when we started our direct lending business in 2010, kind of in the back end of the great financial crisis, the space really began to grow as a function of government regulation, which was intended to de-risk banks and, you know, for good reasons. You know, banks are very highly leveraged. They use depositor money to make loans. And many of those banks are, you know, systemic with respect to the broader economy. And, you know, direct lenders are kind of none of those, which is great. So I think it's actually been a policy success that the private credit world has grown as much as it has, in that, you know, our investors are institutions, endowments, accredited investors. We're not using depositor money. Our leverage is quite limited. And I think that there was a recent IMF paper that talked about private credit regulation, and it acknowledges those benefits of this risk residing within the private credit markets relative to the regulated bank markets. I think the other side of that coin is, of course, that as the sector grows, there are appropriate safeguards around valuations and marks, investor disclosures, all of which are things I think that the SEC is absolutely focused on already with respect to private investing in general, including private equity. And I think that organizations that have been in public markets already through publicly traded BDCs really have a big advantage in that sense. You know, I think it's a two-sided coin, but I do think that on balance, the growth of direct lending is frankly a regulatory success as opposed to something that we should really worry about and try to further restrict.
All right, great. Well, we'll wrap things up there. Javier and Sam, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast.
Thank you.
Thank you, Katie.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Middle Market Growth Conversations. If you haven't yet, please subscribe to the podcast in Apple Podcasts or on Spotify to make sure you never miss an episode. And if you liked what you heard today, please give us a rating and write a review. It really does go a long way in helping other listeners find out about us. This podcast is produced by the Association for Corporate Growth, the largest membership association for middle market M&A and corporate growth professionals. We host networking events across the world. We publish magazines and special reports and much, much more. Learn more about the benefits of membership at acg.org and consider joining us as a member. Last thing, if there is a topic you want to hear us talk about on this podcast, a guest you think would be great, or even if you just have some general feedback you want to share, we would love to hear about it. please send us a note to editor@acg.org. Thanks again for listening.